Conversation Hour on ABC Local Radio Queensland.
10 past 11, my guest today is Lady Carol Kiddu. She grew up in the what used to be the sleepy outer suburb of Brisbane, Shorncliffe. It's now this beautiful, desirable, what's waterfront, you know, expensive, desirable place to live property of the. But in the 50s and 60s, at a time of the White Australia policy, it was very different. Do you notice many changes there, Carol, have you?
I've only been back twice, I think, and driven past the old house and things. Yeah, and it's completely different, yeah.
Completely different.
Very upmarket, yeah.
Very upmarket now. Sean Dorney is my co-host this morning. Sean used to be the ABC's PNG correspondent for, it seemed like forever, Sean. How long was it, 2 decades?
Better part of. Yeah,
better part 17, of 2 decades.
17 years, but 17 I had years? Spent 3 years as well, three earlier years. Than that.
Lady Carol Kiddu is now Papua New Guinean Minister for Community Development. And I want to talk a little bit about that later on, Carol. But just take me back to your life in Shorncliffe in Queensland, first of all. Just tell us a little bit about where you came from, because your journey to PNG is a fascinating story.
Well, I guess I came from an average working class family, Australian family. Spent my time sailing sabots, swimming, going off to swimming training. My brother on the prawn trawlers and eating prawns and going out into the paddocks collecting mushrooms and a typical 50s, 60s life, yeah.
Were you much of a swimmer?
Yes. Ah. I was a good swimmer, but never really champion level, but I could win my races at my local level, yes.
At school?
Few prizes. School and, yeah, a few competitions. It was good fun. It held me in good stead later in Papua New Guinea, coastal
Certainly.
Village, yes. Yeah. And so I don't know what else I want to say. I grew up in a family that was always had a very strong social conscience. You know, we learnt about equality of different peoples and all those ideals. And so that was ingrained into me as an early child.
Was that unusual? I mean, the 40s and 50s then.
Probably.
It was sort of the time of the White Australia policy at that time.
Yeah, I think, it probably was unusual. I'm sure it was. Mm. But they were the ethical standards that mum and dad brought us up with,
Did they have a particular religious philosophy or a political philosophy?
No,
it was just,
if anything.
Or just very socially minded?
Socially minded, We were not a religious family, didn't go to church and things of that nature at all. It was more socially grounded and probably leftist politics.
Yep. What were the dreams? Sorry, Sean, go on.
I was going to say, did you, at that stage, have much interest in politics, Australian politics?
No,
I mean,
no,
your parents weren't involved
I had
in any
no
political
interest,
party
no.
or anything?
No. And I had no interest in politics until 30th of January 1993. No interest at all, yeah.
What happened on the 30th of January 1993?
That's when my husband died of a sudden heart attack. And it was after that event that, I started thinking that way. If the day before someone had said, you'll be in politics one day, I would have said they were absolutely mad. Right. Yeah, I'd never voted in my life until I voted for myself, because voting's not compulsory in Papua New Guinea.
Well, I'll talk to you more about your husband in just a moment. What were your dreams as a young woman in Brisbane growing up at that time? You were a great swimmer. Your brothers were working to prawn trawlers. An average swimmer. Your brothers were working to prawn trawlers. You're enjoying life in Shorncliffe when it wasn't developed and very different to what it is now?
I don't know. I guess I wanted to be a teacher. And for a strange reason, all three of us, the three children, we all became teachers, and yet neither of our parents were teachers. But I don't know that I had any grand dreams. I just wanted to be a teacher. I always felt for other people, but I was always interested in other countries, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've got a very bad memory, Sean. Steve? Yeah.
What did you do, sort of, you'd grown up, you'd sort of blossomed into a young woman. Tell me about the journey before you met the man you married, the Papua New Guinean Buri Kiddu.
The journey before I met him? Just a typical teenager in those years. Probably not exactly conservative, but I didn't get into the Beatles and all those things. I'd listen to them, but I kind of didn't get into all of that. And I was a very, I don't know. Don't know what I was. You're asking a very difficult question, Steve. Ask someone else those questions.
Flicking through your autobiography, I came across a photo of you in Hanau Abada in 1963.
Yes,
how did that come about? You went to PNG?
65.
65. Was that was before you met Buri, was it?
No, after. After, I met, so it was 65. I met Buri in 64. at Talabudra Fitness Camp, where a group of high school, my grade 11 girlfriends and I went there. And at that stage, the boys on scholarships, the colonial scholarships from Papua New Guinea, would go to Talabudra each August holiday. So that's where we met. And then that photo in Hanuabada was when, as a already not really in university, I was going into university. I went up on a university work camp because I guess I'd fallen madly in love with rose-tinted glasses, and I went to have a look at the place, I guess, myself and my sister.
Yeah, Hanuabada, for our listeners, is the village on the water in Port Moresby Harbour, which biggest is one, Moresby is sort of grown around Hanuabada, this village which is built on stilts out into the water.
Yeah, okay.
The biggest village with enormous problems nowadays.
Mm. So you met Buri, he was on a scholarship from Toowoomba Grammar, you met at this camp.
Yeah.
Okay. And
he was school captain, actually.
Yeah. I believe he was the first foreign student to become a captain of a greater public school. Yeah, he was a kind of a first in many ways. He was a unique person, very, very, very unique.
Tell me about him.
In what way?
Well, all I know is that he ended up becoming the Chief Justice of Papua New Guinea, which is a significant...
Yeah, he was absolutely committed to the country and to his people, but... I think at the first meeting, I remember we were at the camp. We'd arrived there the day before, and at those camps in those days, I don't know if they still do it in school here, we're always playing ball games, the volleyball, the tunnel ball. I don't know if they, not volleyball, tunnel ball, captain ball, those things.
Yep.
And we're playing those when the bus came in, and there were all these fellows got off the bus, and they were the boys from Papua New Guinea. And then at the meal that night, I don't know. I think they all must go down and target which young lady they want to get a hold of. I don't know. But at that meal that night, this young fellow kept coming across, kept asking straight towards me, could he have the butter? Could he have the jam? Could he have the... But already we'd been targeting. And one of my friends, one of my friends, Lorraine, had said that she wanted that one, that they were calling the chief. And so I kept saying, oh, ask Lorraine, because I didn't want to upset my friend. And every time he approached me, I'd say, ask Lorraine, ask Lorraine. But somehow we got past that. And then he realized he wasn't making progress, I guess, on this very direct approach. And so he used then the Papuan way of approaching girls. And this was absolutely, to me, it was quite incredible. I was walking along near a building, and then one of the youngest Papua New Guinea boys, Papuan boys there, came running along and said, the chief is willing. And I thought, what the hell is this about? What's the chief willing to do? And I was thinking... And I got really indignant, you know, this indirect way of speaking to me, because to me it was really strange. And I said, well, tell him to tell me himself. I don't know what I said. But I found out later, really, that was my first lesson in culture, because in those days, a male and a female would never approach each other directly. It was always by a go-between. A male would approach a female through a go-between. So he decided to use the Papuan way of a go-between to try to attract me.
Did you find that attractive, doing it that way?
I was probably confused, but certainly I was attracted to him, yeah. Mm. But I was probably confused. I don't know.
Tell me a bit more about him. He's described as a visionary. You told me when you first met, you obviously went out, went places together.
No, not really. We were there at a holiday camp. We went back to our schools, wrote lots of letters, and that was grade 11, finished our grade 12, and then during... vacations sometimes saw each other. It was not until university days that then we started to, what you'd say in Western terms, court.
So you built a relationship through letter writing.
Through letter writing,
so
yes,
got to know the man, got to know the person.
Yeah, in many ways, shared many of his thoughts about things, yeah. And,
What was your parents' initial reaction?
I don't know. I think I was so... Mum says now that when I got back from camp, she knew that I was really, I don't know what you'd call it, that something had really struck me.
Mothers can pick it sometimes, can't they?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But when I think of it now, they probably were extremely worried, but they couldn't go back on what they'd always taught me. And so, and I guess they were really people out of their era in a way, because they were criticised, I've found out since too. I was blind to everything, absolutely blind with thinking, you know, obsessed by this young fellow. But I'm sure that they worried a lot about, well, what would happen if it became a permanent relationship and whether it would work out and the problems that I would face. I was just didn't even think about them.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think it's probably quite cool. I remember once when I was a young man, my dad said to me, "Now, mate, don't marry someone who's not of your same race, not of your same culture." You know,
yeah.
It was sort of like it was part of the talk about the facts about life, is how he saw it. He was giving me the facts of life,
yeah.
And the first part of facts of life was don't marry someone that's not like you.
Yeah.
It sounds like your parents sort of had in the back of their mind something similar.
I don't know, but I they were always very supportive because once they'd met Burry. They saw the quality of the person, but I think worried, supportive. They supported me right through then, always, the whole family, my family. And Dad used to lovingly wrap up parcels of things to send us in the early years when we went back as a married couple. And when the rats got to them in customs, well, then Dad started to wrap them in chicken wire as well to make sure they got to us with all the little treats to send up to us and things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, you've married Burry. Mm. What were some of the cultural differences, these little differences that you really noticed? I mean, I know you'd written and you'd had this sort of letter relationship where you'd built an understanding of the chap, because I know that you have some sort of thoughts now on cross-cultural marriages.
Well, yeah.
That I want to hear.
In general, if it's truly a really cross-cultural marriage, I'm not talking about skin colour.
Yes.
I'm talking about a cross-cultural one where it involves perhaps religion or really deep cultural things. In general, I think I probably would advise people against them unless they're really, really sure of their relationship because they're tough. To be quite honest, I don't think I would have been still in Papua New Guinea except the nature of Burry the person, as Sean has said, he was a unique person and a man out of his era. And we had a chance to establish, he had spent, 13 years or something in Australia going through on this scholarship, so he had a pretty good understanding of my cultural background too. So we understood that. I had no understanding of what I was going to. And that was tough, to go into a village, an extended family situation. And it's not anything... It's not really the huge things. It's the subtle, ongoing things that wear you down that you're not used to. The lack of privacy, the fact of no concepts of ownership, particularly then in a village situation, that everything I had belonged to everyone and their things belonged to me too if I wanted to do that. And the fact that you just absolutely had no privacy.
Yeah. Let's turn the tables on Sean Dorney for a moment, Carol, while you're here. Yes. Sean, you've experienced a cross-cultural relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, and like Lady Carol's saying, I think Pauline found it quite difficult moving out of that situation where you actually have all those support mechanisms of the That's village right. and the relatives and everything, and trying to bring up kids in Australia in without a unitary family right. without that
support. That wider, broad support.
Yeah, yeah. I think that...
Yeah, I have a son on a scholarship at present here studying, and... He found it dreadful his first year here. He just found it really hard to cope without the uncles and the brothers and the cousins and everyone around. Just the lack of it all, he found it really, really hard. He was immensely lonely, and even though he had other PNG friends, and he just couldn't cope with it because that's what he grew up in a village, yeah.
Mm.
Tell me about the first time it really struck you that what you owned wasn't yours anymore.
Oh, in many ways. I know that's one thing that upset my mother a lot too, because Mum used to lovingly make all sorts of sew clothes from, you know, Dobie, the first grandchild, all these things. And she'd come up too, and I'd be looking around for one of Dobie's lovely dresses, and suddenly you'd see it down the street there on some other child and everything. And I think my mother found that very hard. Eventually, you know, I just came to accept it, but there were so many ways in which... you did that. But also, you could admire something. In those early days, if I went into someone's house and I said, oh, gee, that's a lovely basket, I soon learnt not to say that, because if you admired something, they were obliged to give it to you. Not just because me, from outside, that was it. You know, there are all these subtleties of culture you have to learn. And I soon learnt not to go and admire things too much, because people would feel an obligation to give it and all sorts of things. Those subtleties have now broken down in Papua New Guinea. Yeah.
For better or for worse, by the way?
Often for the worse.
Hmm.
Yeah, often for the worse. The dignity and beauty of the culture, a lot of that is being lost. I went into a very proud, dignified society. Unfortunately, the village is basically part of the capital city of of the country, and so it's been impacted enormously by urbanization, by all of those things. And I do worry that what you see now is not the true essence of the society at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sean?
I was just going to add to the point you made earlier. It was quite a shock to me when it wasn't that anyone took anything of mine, but things of Pauline's when we first met. We were at the Wonga Hostel at the NBC, and she came down for a broadcast officer's training course, and she bought all these really nice clothes. And I went up to visit her some months later, and none were left.
Yes,
none
at all.
And she had said she'd opened the suitcase and sort
of everything goes.
Cousins and whatever,
everything
just said,
goes.
Oh, I like
that's
that, it. I like
yeah,
this,
yeah.
I like that.
And that's right, and off it goes.
And she expected that to happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, yeah. And it still happens. And you'd walk outside and you'd look for your thongs or whatever, and they'd be gone. Just walk. And even now, I mean, I rarely have enough spoons and knives and forks in my house. They walk. They get legs and walk. You know, people will borrow them, take them. And it's an interesting thing, too, when we talk. I mean, these are subtleties that I think overlap in the pain that we're having growing as a nation, because these concepts of appropriation and misappropriation probably go in with these cultural concepts of honesty and dishonesty. For example, if Buri and I would give relatives some money to help them pay a school fee for their child, and for us in our Western society, of course, where we came from, that had to be for the school fee of the child. But if then they found another more important thing they thought it was for, they use it somewhere else, it was not considered as wrong. We'd get really annoyed because it was for the child, but we knew that they didn't, you know, the money, once the giving had occurred, if they decided there was a greater need, it wasn't really considered as dishonest in any way. And so these subtleties of concepts of honesty and things are very interesting. And I believe for Papua New Guinea to go forward now, we've got to talk beyond the economics of the situation. We need to grow our economy. We need to cut down on the corruption enormously or the various forms of corruption. But I think we've got to really start looking more deeply at the cultural, psychological aspects of the culture.
Lady Carol Kiddu is my guest. It's 27 minutes past 11.
The Conversation Hour on ABC Local Radio Queensland.
News headlines just a few minutes away, but Sean, I know you had a question you wanted to put to Carol.
Yes, I'm just wondering about the marriage at Cromwell College. At the university. You were at uni too, were you?
I'd finished by then. I didn't finish my degree. I was frantically in love and I was putting pressure on Buri. He avoided the issue of marriage completely. In fact, he said, no, we shouldn't get married, because I think he anticipated, you know, that would be difficult. And eventually when I persevered and persevered, he actually said to me, never ask me to choose. And I asked him, what do you mean? He said, well, never ask me to choose between you and my people. Because I tell you now, I won't choose you, I'll choose my people. And I mean, it was a very sobering thing. And I always remember that later when we were going through the normal ups and downs of married life. I used to think, well, he put it on the line for me. But by that stage I was out teaching. I left my university work, went to Kelvin Grove Teachers College, became a teacher, so we had a income. And we married at Cromwell College, a very small wedding, but lots of people turned up. It was really nice. My teaching friends from Chinchilla all came down and attended, although it was not, there were no official invitations even. So it was really nice. And one of the other PNG students, who's now a minister of state also, he's the party leader of the party I'm in, he decided that he'd decorate the church. And so he went around St. Lucia stealing flowers from every garden he could. And he was taking flowers from the gardens and he decorated the church with stolen flowers. And so...
Very
Papua
New Guinea.
Yeah, it's a joke. Oh, dear.
And you've raised.
I still rubbish him about the stolen flowers.
The Conversation Hour on ABC Local Radio Queensland.
My co-host is the ABC's Sean Dorney. Our guest is Lady Carol Kiddu. Carol grew up in the outer Brisbane suburb of Shorncliffe. In the 50s and 60s, she is now the Papua New Guinean Minister for Community Development. She's the country's only female cabinet minister and the only non-Indigenous woman to enter politics in PNG. Carol, you told me before the news headlines that that one of your sons found it quite difficult culturally schooling down here and missed those group, family and tribal connections of the uncles and the cousins or what have you. Mm. How have the rest of your children coped with those cross-cultural issues?
I guess because they grew up in it, they're probably psychologically perhaps more Papua New Guinean than Western and culturally. I'm quite sure there were tough times, but particularly for the girls. Not the boys so much, because in Motu society, which is a tribal group I married into, males are, well, in most societies in PNG, males are considered as more important, more prominent, and they're treated they're just treated like kings sometimes, males, whereas girls have to work and work very hard. And it's hard for girls nowadays in modern PNG to, as we're trying to move forward, dealing with these things. I mean, forced arranged marriages are still occurring. There was a very sad case just about a month ago. A young grade 10 student committed suicide. She couldn't face the fact that she was being forced into a marriage. So with girls, you know, there were a lot of cultural expectations, which, of course, Buri and I did not put on them, but the society at large did, you know, as to the expectations. So I'd say the girls found it harder, much harder than the boys.
I was in a taxi. You're quite well known, by the way. I suspect it's because of various things, including that excellent Australia story that was done last year on you. But a taxi driver said to me just weeks ago, he said, that woman, that Australian woman who's up there in member of PNG Parliament, why does she let her daughter stay in PNG? And it just knocked me over completely because I was thinking, I said, well, they're actually part New Guineans.
Yeah, very much
They're not Australians, and they actually would regard themselves as part New Guineans.
Well, it's interesting, Sean, because the people are now getting ready towards 2007, and my opponents are getting ready to get rid of the old woman, as they call me. And one of them was said to one of my supporters, you know, that old woman, she may have married a black man, but she's got a white brain, you know. And so we're really still trying to work out whether my children's brains are white, black or grey. And we're trying to find out.
I think you're fine. They're a very, very interesting combination.
Yes, yeah.
Your husband, Buri, was Chief Justice of Papua New Guinea in the 1990s. Was it him that inspired...
80s, actually.
In the 1980s, I'm sorry. Was it him that inspired you, that inspired in you a desire to get into politics? As I understand it, culturally, there was some sort of expectation that you take on a mantle after he dies.
No. I had absolutely no interest in politics. I think it was just an interest in social issues. Actually, Sean was there when I won the first election. But I think it was his very, very strong sense of social justice and injustice and his increasing concern about the breaches of human rights in certain ways that have occurred. And that, I guess. And then when he was not reappointed as Chief Justice in August 1993, there were a lot of pressure on him, a lot of people coming to him and saying, stand for politics, we want you to be our Papuan Prime Minister, and talking at him. And he used to say to me sometimes on the veranda, he'd say, oh, I don't know if I want to go into politics. And I remember I said to him once, you're not going to escape, the people are just going to, they'll force you into it. And he turned on me and said, well, why don't you bloody well do it? And I often thought about that. And and it's a strange thing, he used to say to people, look, give me 6 months, just let me sort out what I'm going to do because I have to start working again to get an income. And almost basically 6 months almost to the day, he died of a sudden heart attack. And he never did answer anyone about whether he would or would not stand for politics. It was really quite strange.
Steve, can I just give a little bit of background?
Please, that'll be good.
To this. He took over as Chief Justice at a very, very difficult time. Yeah. What had happened is that the then Justice Minister, Naha Rooney, who was one of the few female parliamentarians before Lady Carol, had been found guilty by the Supreme Court of contempt of court. At that stage, it was a court that was dominated by Australian jurists. And she got jailed for 8 months, and the Prime Minister, Sir Michael Somare, let her out after one night. And amongst the various repercussions of this, as more than 1,000 prisoners around the rest of the country decided, well, if it's all right for the Justice Minister, it's all right for us. And there were mass breakouts all over Papua New Guinea. Yeah. But as a result of that, the Chief Justice at the time and an enormous number of judges resigned in protest. And so it was a crucial moment for Papua New Guinea and a real question of whether the judiciary would remain independent. And Suburi then was asked to become Chief Justice, and lots of question marks about, is this going to be a reliable judiciary? Is this going to just be a politically appointed bench that does whatever the government of the day wants it to do? And over 10 years, Suburi built up the reputation of that court as being significantly independent.
Yeah. He was fanatical about independence of judiciary, and he achieved what hasn't been achieved in several other countries in the Pacific, and was a claim for it that he fought and fought to get independent financing of the judiciary, independent from the Department for Justice, so that the judges were not at the mercy of the Minister for Justice of the day. And right to nowadays, the judiciary has its own appropriation bill and has independent financing, and he achieved that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, it's an interesting
situation. And that's why he was disliked by some of the politicians of the day.
It's an interesting situation where the finance bureaucrats can't determine what the budget for the judiciary is going to be. The judiciary, the parliament, and then the rest of the bureaucracy are all funded out of different appropriations.
Mm.
And so the Speaker and the Chief Justice have enormous influence over how big their budget's going to be, and it does help preserve that independence. Yeah. It's a very interesting thing that PNG
and that's
done.
A key difference with other Pacific Island nations.
I think
Carol,
it's different from
yes.
Australia.
Yes, yes, that's right. I think it is. Yeah, it was. I know other Chief Justices, when I met them at conferences, used to say to me what he had achieved in doing that. You know, and he just steadfastly kept pushing and pushing because he saw that independence of the independent financing of the judiciary was very important.
And the reason he lost his job after 10 years, or they didn't reappoint him, basically, is that he was seen as being a bit too independent.
Yeah, yeah, and he wouldn't
bow to
the wishes of the day.
Which is code for we can't rein him in.
Yes, exactly. They couldn't rein him in, and so it was better not to reappoint because the Chief Justice is appointed by Cabinet under our Constitution.
And the
so
Prime
Cabinet
Minister
chose
started
not to
attacking him in speeches and things, and which caused quite a bit of consternation at the time in PNG because he was extremely well regarded outside of politics.
So it was a very emotional time, and his death left me with enormous anger because basically I did blame those events for his death. And I guess that's another thing that drove me to say, well, I'll get you a pass.
What were some of the things that he revealed to you when talking to you as his wife of the frustrations of those who are those in Parliament who are using the protection of Parliament to attack the Chief Justice of the courts?
He didn't speak about it much at all. And I realise now that he was internalising an enormous amount. Sometimes I would say to him things like, why don't you say something? Why don't you speak out? And he says, no. And when it came to the time that our appointment or non-reappointment, and he wasn't pensionable age, he was basically dumped without a pension, and that's why he had to find another way to get an income. I said to him, why don't you tell them you just want 2 years to, and then you'll retire and take your pension? And he turned on me and said, I will never bargain for my job, and don't you ever expect me to do that? Yeah. He was an incredible person.
At the funeral service, it was an extraordinary emotional situation. It was terrific numbers of people turned up, but also the Chief Ombudsman or former Chief Ombudsman gave an extraordinarily hard-hitting eulogy in which he just attacked the Prime Minister and the government of the day for having killed Suburi. It was very, very interesting and emotional.
And I guess it's because of all of those circumstances. I was charged with anger. I was writing letters to the editor, attacking everything that was happening in government at the time. And I guess it's those things. It was that really prompted me to go into politics, yeah. My desire to see greater social justice, but also it was pushed by a passion of anger.
Where did your support come from? You got into politics. Who was supporting you? Was it those
tough
issues?
I had to. Politics in Papua New Guinea is not about issues, really. It may come that way a little bit more now, but not really. Politics is about just numbers and base votes and numbers. So I had to work on getting Buri's base village to support me as much as I could get of their support. And that was tough, because for a woman and a widow to go into politics was really unthought of. And so I went through lots and lots of lead up to it. I asked one of the elders that I thought would be sympathetic to call a family meeting. And then we went into a clan meeting. Then we went to Buri's grave and asked permission. The elders asked permission for him to do this. And the still strong feeling. I felt very guilty for what I was doing to his family, because I was asking them to do something that was so against the culture. But they did, in general. I got a good vote from the village and a good vote in many places. At the time, the diplomatic circles thought I was crazy. They said, is she mad? But in my heart, I knew I would win, because Buri and I had always been with the people. I'd done a lot of some charitable type works and things like that. And I worked very hard at it. I went and worked for the man who stole the flowers. He was a minister at the time, so I went and worked in his office to get a feel of it. And after hours, I'd go and get my torch and climb up into the settlements and try to meet people for years, several years beforehand. I was just driven by this passion that I don't know what.
you got quite a remarkable vote,
yes,
actually.
Higher out of than those, ever before.
Out of those settlements. Now, those settlements are not Papuan people, are they?
No.
Mostly, what, Southern Highlander or Highlanders?
Mm,
and
yeah.
So,
and
just forgive me for my ignorance, but just explain that why that difference is important, that difference of Papuan versus Southern Highland.
Oh, well, you rely on your one talk vote. One talk is your same ethnic group.
Okay.
And basically, yeah, you rely on that getting you in Papua New Guinea. And for other people of other ethnic groups to vote for someone, you have to really work on that.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
And Moresby is, of course, because of migration, urbanisation, it's become this huge melting pot of lots of different people from all over different parts of PNG. And an electorate
and
like Carroll's.
Mine is a very tough electorate. It's the poorest electorate in the city.
Is it really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you're dealing with all these different squatter settlements, which are people from all sorts of different areas who don't speak the same languages.
So regarded as probably one of the toughest electorates in the country. Even though it's urban, it hasn't got the suburbs where the public servants live. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working with people who are, in a lot of poverty,
yes,
unemployment, street vendors, all those areas.
And the really, really remarkable thing about Carroll's political career is that in Moresby, there is almost always a turnover of members of
Parliament.
You'll
see how I go next time.
Somebody lasts only 5
maybe
years,
the
and
white,
then they're ditched because they
haven't
been able.
Maybe the white brain will be a problem.
They haven't been able to deliver, but she's actually managed to win that extraordinarily tough electorate twice.
I doubled my vote last time, I think also in the first win, the thing that I did an educational campaign. Nothing handed out. Of course, you have to have something to eat for people, because people are hungry and they expect. And I mean, going to all the different camps during elections is a big thing, because you get your stomach filled with scone and tea or something. Some people kill pigs. Well, I can't afford pigs, so I had scone and tea. But I also I really strategized, and I did an educational campaign. I spent 6 months doing what is politics, what's the work of a politician. People found it just so different. I think that kind of attracted people. Then when campaign opened, then we had other people saying, who is she, what is my, and it was all visual because I'm a teacher by background and I used those skills. And I had boys from the street drew big charts for me, and we'd have all this picture talk in different languages as my lead up. Yeah. So I worked very hard to win the election.
You're going to stand for the next election coming whenever it comes.
That'll be my last one. Yeah, 2007. I'll probably stand again, and we'll see how we go.
Now, there's a lovely difference in the way politics is run there, as I understand it. That the local member, like you're expected to sort of fork out and dig into your pocket to help the locals.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd love to go on to John Howard and say, John, I need 1,000.
Yeah. Well, that's what wears me out. I enjoy the parliamentary work. I enjoy the legislation, policy, and the issues. Because there's an enormous amount to be done, very challenging. But the electorate, although I love my electorate, it also wears me down enormously. Mm. I think my best application was at the end of the last year, where a man sat looking glaring at me all day, and I'd been having ministerial meetings all day, and he had no appointment to see me. Eventually, I said to one of my staff, "What's he here for?" And he said, "He wants you to fix his toilet door." I said, "Get him out of here before I kill him."
I wonder how many Australian ministers have people saying, yeah, come and fix my toilet thing.
Carol, I want to ask you something about how you see our view of PNG. We see the news at night on ABC and commercial TV, and you build a very
negative,
myopic picture of PNG, and you think the place looks like a social disaster, and that all that we're throwing all our aid money down the drain, and we've got a new system now where it's linked to certain projects only. Can you give me like an overview of how should we see, as you as a cabinet minister, how should we see PNG in its situation? Where does it sit in the greater scheme of things at this point in time?
One, I think we need to do more work on making aid more effective in some aspects of aid. But another thing is that we've got to look at the complexities, understand the complexities of the nation and have some patience and understand that we cannot impose. We're going to have to grow the country from inside out, grow the communities from inside out. We have a situation where over 80%, I'd say at least 80% of the people are probably caught in what I call a time warp. We have not brought them forward in terms of being able to cope with what they need to cope with today. They are limited by being functional literacy is probably about 30% if we're lucky, really being able to function in a literate society. There are over 800 languages. So they're limited by being illiterate and by having basically only a traditional skills base. And we need to very urgently find ways for mass education to give people the knowledge and skills to use their land in new ways. Because in Papua New Guinea, the government does not own the wealth of the country. The people own the land. And yet we've got them, their minds geared wrongly psychologically, where they think that they need to be employed, whereas reality, their land is what will employ them. And we've perhaps the Western form of thinking about education, everything, has done a lot of damage. And we have to now re-gear the nation. And we've got to understand that what we grow in Papua New Guinea, our form of democracy, our form of society, we have to do it. I'm not saying it's Australia's fault. But we in Papua New Guinea, we've now got to really become very self-analytical and look at the cultural change, the psychology of the nation. How do we want our nation to go? What is the identity of a nation of 1,000 tribes? And how do we grow a nation so that we don't disintegrate and have, you know, recurrence of the Bougainville type experience and things like that. I would like also for Australians to realise that what you hear here in Australia, that's a minority of people, of Papua New Guinea people involved in the criminal and all of those things. We have majority of people, still very open-hearted people, very kind, generous people, living perhaps difficult lives, self-reliant in their villages, extremely remote. They'll have to work 1-2 days to a clinic and they die in the process sometimes. Women die in childbirth. But, you know, don't see Papua New Guinea as just a country with complete lawlessness. Mm. I feel safer inside villages and even in my own settlements than I would perhaps walking in parts of Australia, to be quite honest, because I know the social circumstances there. We have problems, there's no doubt on that. We have now the enhanced cooperation package and things like that. But time and patience are needed to grow a nation.
And it's got to grow from within the people at a very grassroots level, up through the village level.
That's why I've had this huge focus on integrated community development, because we've left the mass of our people behind. In our obsession with our natural resources, we are a very resource-rich nation. We have mineral resources, we have forests, we have fisheries, and of course other people are very interested in our forests and things. But sometimes that mass exploitation of those natural resources doesn't benefit the majority of people. The trickle-down doesn't occur. And we've got to really get to the majority of our people and help them to have the skills to develop their land and become commercially and financially viable with their land. Yeah.
I want to wrap things up by I want to wrap things up. Just, I'm rapidly running out of time, so forgive me, but just tell me specifically about your home, your house. I believe it's very different from what we would expect.
When we came to, I live in customary land, about 20 minutes out of the city. And when we came to designing the house, I worked with Buri's brother, who's an architect, and I decided to take apart the house, not to build a house in the Western sense, with one set of outer walls. And so we have a section that is kind of like the kitchen and what was the meeting room. And then we have little walkways in their little separate areas. We worked on trying to design a house that was catered for extended family life, but also provided a degree of privacy and having your own little space as well.
You've tried to find that cultural meeting place, haven't you, in your house?
Yes. And it's been very successful. I love the design. And when I go and join Buri or whatever in the other, whatever we go to, it could be used very usefully as a backpackers by the children to become an income. It's been designed kind of like that.
It's not actually in the village itself. It's a bit separated from it.
In fact, to get there,
you have to drive through a military barracks, the Tarama military barracks.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
Lady Carol Kiddo, it's a fascinating story. Yeah. All the best for the future.
You.
Thank you for coming in and joining me in conversation.
Thank you.
And Sean, thanks for giving me the benefit of your wisdom.